This is section 316, Sonia Johnson, Mormon Feminist Role Model or Cautionary Tale. I'm to remind everyone first to turn off cell phones and any other noise-making devices. And I think actually that's the only thing I have to say to you other than welcome. We're happy to have you here this early session. Our two presenters this morning are Kay Gaisford and Nadine Hansen. Kay has a bachelor's and a master's degree in communications from Stanford University, and also an education degree from Stanford. She has, as you can tell from the biography that's printed, is a desktop publisher and teaches computer skills. She has lived in places all over the country and in Europe, and she has four children who live all over the country and in Europe. Nadine has a bachelor's degree in economics from San Jose State University and a law degree from Santa Clara University, and which she acquired when the oldest of her four children graduated from high school. Is that right? Okay. Okay. And she lives in Cedar City and has also lived on the peninsula, the Bay Area. Paula Goodfellow's name is on the program, but she was not able to attend, and Kay will probably be able to present some of her remarks, however. So we'll turn the time over to Kay.
Thank you. Recently, a group of young Mormon feminists in the Phoenix area started a book group, and they invited some of us older feminists to join them. The current selection for August is Sonia Johnson's book, her autobiography, From Housewife to Heretic. So when I picked that up and reread it and realized that it's the 30th anniversary year of her excommunication, I suggested that we try to do a panel at Sunstone to give an outline of what happened. Now, looks like this audience is mostly of an age where you would have known what was going on, so I hope it won't be too repetitious. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about what went on, just an overview and some of the highlights. Nadine was there and knew Sonia, and so she'll give some of her personal reflections. Unfortunately, Paula, as Karen mentioned, was not able to be here. If there's time, I'll give some of her thoughts. But we also have in the audience Teddy Wood, who I'll introduce as one of Sonia's colleagues in Mormons for ERA. So hopefully she'll have be able to say something to us too. In 1776, Abigail Adams wrote to her husband John, "In the new code of laws, remember the ladies and do not put such unlimited power in the hands of men." John Adams replied, "I cannot but laugh. Depend upon it, we know better than to repeal our masculine systems." So this is nothing new and has gone on throughout our republic as well as in the past. The ERA was introduced with every session of Congress beginning in 1923, and in 1972, it was passed by Congress and sent to the states for ratification, with a seven-year time limit for passage. The deadline was later extended for three more years to 1982. 22 of the necessary 38 state ratifications occurred in the first year, but the pace slowed as opposition began to organize, and only 35 states eventually ratified before the deadline. After the failure of ERA in 1982, it has been reintroduced in every subsequent Congress, most recently on July 21st of this year. A website devoted to the history of the ERA gives specific mention to the anti-ERA work of Phyllis Schlafly, a right-wing leader of Eagle Forum and Stop ERA, but gives no mention to the Mormon Church, which would be lumped into the general statement, "Opposition to the ERA was also organized by fundamentalist religious groups." Perhaps we feminist Mormons credit more influence to the Mormon Church than we should. The first LDS statement against the ERA didn't come for 2 years, until December 1974, when Reeves-Sided President Barbara Smith, speaking at the University of Utah Institute, stated, "I would like to eradicate laws and practices unfair to women and men while keeping laws that provide for their special needs. It is my considered judgment that the Equal Rights Amendment is not the way." A church news editorial followed a month later, and 2 years later, in 1976, the First Presidency issued an official statement on the ERA. "We firmly believe that the Equal Rights Amendment is not the answer. We fear it will even stifle many God-given feminine instincts. It would strike at the family." 2 years later, in late 1978, the church's anti-ERA rhetoric was translated into anti-ER action in Virginia wards and stakes and other states still considering ratification. Thanks. Following an organizational meeting in November 1978, prompted from a visit by Apostle Gordon B. Hinckley, members were told they had priesthood callings to lobby the Virginia legislature. Anti-ERA petitions turned up in ward lobbies, 150,000 pamphlets, which were co-authored by the LDS group and Phyllis Schlafly's group, were distributed. Ward bishops solicited donations to support the effort. The women in the Oakton State were told that not to say they were Mormons when they lobbied against ERA, nor to admit that men had called them and initiated the organization. Distressed to see the church being turned into a political lobbying group, four Mormon women friends in Virginia decided to not only continue their lobbying efforts in support of ERA, but to publicize how church male leaders were involved in organizing local women to fight the ERA. The first one is Hazel Davis Rigby, down there in the right-hand corner. And as you see, all of these women were from Idaho and Utah, small towns. And the next one above is Meta Withers. And they had been friends for a long time. Teddy Wood, who is with us today. And Teddy was, I failed to get in where she's from. She was from Rexburg, Idaho. And Sonia Johnson, from Malad, Idaho. Sonia had an EDD degree and had been employed as a part-time teacher of English in universities, both in the United States and abroad, following her husband to new places of employment. They returned to the United States, settling in Virginia in 1976. All four of the founders of ERA were frequently interviewed and very visible after the Eastern Press picked up the story that the church was an unregistered anti-ERA force in Virginia. How did Sonia become the chief spokesperson? Sonia says repeatedly in her autobiography that whenever a spokesperson was needed, she was the one available. Ironically, she was the only one that didn't have a full-time job. The others were all working and not always available. She had stopped teaching university classes. Meta Withers suggested to me in a phone conversation a few weeks ago that perhaps one reason Sonia was galvanized to an extreme was that she had been absent from the discussion and was ignorant of the feminist movement that had blossomed in the 60s and 70s. Meta commented that if they had been casting a play with characters, Sonia was well cast. In her reports for Utah Holiday Magazine, Linda Silito said Sonia's image made her an ideal spokesperson for Mormons for ERA. Sonia's musical voice and quotability were not what made her spokesperson. She was chosen for her orthodoxy. She was ward organist, taught in Relief Society, had four children, a temple recommend, a two-year supply of food in her basement. She looked and sounded like a typical Mormon woman of the era. She didn't even own a pair of Levi's, Teddy told me. Others among the four were less prototypically Mormon, including earlier involvement in activism such as civil rights and during the Vietnam War. But in her autobiography, Sonia Johnson describes some early unorthodox tendency toward outspokenness, independent thinking, and willingness to question authority. One example I liked, she told about a chastity a night presentation to young women when she was about 15. She listened to the speaker talk about the evils of physical intimacy, tearing petals from a rose and crushing them, the speaker concluding, "If you sully your body by allowing boys to touch it in forbidden places, you can never be whole or beautiful or pure again, just as the petals of the rose can never be pure and white again." She describes her reaction. She might be the wife of a local dignitary of the church. She might be a temple worker. I might be only 15 years old, but I knew the gospel of Jesus Christ, and I knew she was dead wrong. The next Sunday was fast and testimony meeting. It is hard for me to believe now how naive I was that day. I had no idea that when I rose and said what I had to say, I was going to upset anybody. I rose and told the congregation that a temple worker had come and preached false doctrine to us young women. I described her performance and attacked her conclusion on the basis that Christ had taught repentance as a method of becoming totally whole and pure and beautiful again. Though your sins be scarlet, they shall be white as snow. When I sat down, the president of the Young Women's Organization stood up. She castigated me for my insensitivity to the Spirit, which the temple worker's speech had showered upon our youthful heads. Others followed her, denouncing me in a less direct way. Sonia Johnson continued to be naive all the way through her excommunication. Those who have read her autobiography will remember that she was naive enough to comply with her husband when he suggested that they get a fake divorce in 1979 that would supposedly help them work on their marriage. Sonia didn't begin to describe herself as a feminist until after a meeting in spring 1977 when the state president came to her ward to explain the church's opposition to the ERA. He read the text of the proposed amendment, which is the first line of which is over on the right there. Equality under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state on account of sex. She describes her reaction. When he read those words, they took hold of my heart like a great warm fist and have not let go for one single second, waking or sleeping. He converted me heart and soul to the Equal Rights Amendment. In a tremendous psychic explosion, my defense gave way. My 42-year-old file, which had been absolutely bulging with data about what it means to be female in a male world, exploded. Sonia struggled and prayed over the dissonance between her convictions about equal rights and the position taken by her church. In an interview that appeared in a 1980 book, Mormons and Women, she said, "It was so important that it seemed to me it deserved revelation, that the least the prophet could do was to go into a closet and ask, now, I believe that a prophet is a prophet when he speaks as a prophet. I believe he has not fasted and prayed about this." Throughout her autobiography, she describes the fervent prayers that preceded decisions and actions in her daily life, as well as when she faced important moments, like her August 4, 1978 testimony before the U.S. Senate Congressional Rights Subcommittee as part of a panel of religious women. "I prayed every Sunday before I played the organ, and much of the time during. Praying and playing music go naturally together for me. I pray every night and believe in praying every morning, though I often forgot but made up for it during the day, praying informally as I went about my work." So it was unthinkable not to pray long and hard about the testimony I was writing, since it was crucial to get it just right. During her testimony, Utah Senator Orrin Hatch addressed her with questions and tone of voice that attracted attention from the press. UPI reporter Cheryl Arvidson said he got mean and personal. He denigrated her. It was his tone. Sonia commented, "People said to me afterward, his voice became so odd when he questioned you. What happened to his voice?" And I said, "Oh, he put on his priesthood voice with me." Beta told me that when they learned about the initial organization meeting for anti-ERA activities, Hazel petitioned that it not be held in a church building, and it was moved. Mormons for ERA soon realized that political efforts were being encouraged, if not directed, by higher authorities. Sonia was among the numerous women who wrote to President Spencer Kimball, earnestly hoping that he would support their cause if only he could hear their viewpoint. "Initially, we never imagined that the church would be serious about opposing the ERA movement because we thought there was a positive attitude in the Mormon church toward women," Maida Withers said in a phone conversation with me. "We were innocent at the beginning of the venom that would occur. In our innocence, we stood our ground and kept asserting that the amendment would be good for women and good for families. We stood up for the lives we were living. We had full-time jobs. We just didn't get it as it became almost doctrinal. Suddenly, I was seeing my church as an Old Testament church, and I was disappointed." In the Salt Lake Tribune in November 1979, Sonia was quoted, "I think the critical issue is the separation of church and state. The whole church is organized to the hilt to fight the ERA. They have these meetings in our church houses. It's gotten to be so that to be against the ERA is almost a doctrine of the church. You shouldn't have to choose between your church and your politics." Mormons for ERA asked Virginia church leaders to make their ERA actions public, which would put the sudden influx of concerned citizens lobbying legislators into perspective. "If you don't tell them, we will," Sonia Johnson insisted. In a Washington Post article, Marjorie Heyer reported that Mormons for ERA forced the church to register as a lobbyist and became a sort of truth squad, attacking the church's opposition in states where ratification is an issue. Getting press seemed to be the only way to get their cause heard. Mormons for ERA decided to reach church leaders and the public awareness through the media, but they soon learned that while they could attract press, they could not always control it. They pointed out the church's guiding hands behind state organizations, urging the press and legislators to consider the Mormon influence that was resulting in the large influx of mail and visits. In summer 1978, Sonia Johnson, her husband Rick, and 20 of their friends marched in an ERA parade down Pennsylvania Avenue, carrying a banner that read "Mormons for ERA." in mid-August of 78, when Utah Senators Hatch and Garn announced they would lead a filibuster against an extension to the against voting for an extension to the ratification deadline, Sonya Johnson sent Hatch a telegram announcing that she would begin fasting on the Capitol grounds as soon as the filibuster began. Mormons for ERA attracted attention with airplane banners. In Virginia and at General Conference in Utah in the spring of 1978, banners appeared in the sky reading, "Mormons for ERA are everywhere." On July 4th, Ezra Taft Benson, president of the Council of the Twelve, addressed a multi-stake sunrise service in Northern Virginia, and as the flag climbed the pole, a banner was seen overhead, "Raise the flag for ERA." The area conference in Washington, D.C. in September and General Conference in Salt Lake in October saw a new message. Mother in Heaven loves Mormons for ERA. There were demonstrations of demonstrators outside General Conference and votes of no when the congregation was asked to sustain leaders. Sonya's public appearances created controversy and news coverage. Her language helped shape an image of a reckless critic of her own church. A 1979 speech was titled Patriarchal Panic, Sexual Politics in the Mormon Church. Her conclusion was, "We are waking up and growing up, and in our waking and growing can be heard the death rattle of the patriarchy." Another speech, "Off Our Pedestals or Chronicles of the Uppity Sisters," was less strident, but it included the word savage misogyny, which would later damn her in a bishop's court. On November 14th, 1979, her bishop sent her a letter instructing her to attend a bishop's court. 3 days later, as she was leaving for the church building on November 17th, she learned via a phone call from a feminist friend in Salt Lake, Jan Tyler, what the charges would be. Jan had read them in an article in the Salt Lake Tribune. A church spokesman was quoted, "It's not her support of the ERA per se, but what she is leading people to believe about our prophet." On November 17th, she defended herself for 5 hours, pleading for an opportunity to prepare her defense, including bringing witnesses. The trial was recessed until Saturday evening, December 1st. White House advisors Sarah Weddington and Esther Peterson, Esther Peterson's on the right there, passed the hat among Johnson's friends and supporters in D.C. and substantially contributed to plane fare for the Utah witnesses. The fund also underwrote a half-page ad in both major Salt Lake newspapers signed by more than 200 people. On December 1st, vigils were held in Salt Lake City, in the tri-state area of Washington, D.C., and in Los Angeles, where women demonstrated wearing gags. Sonya and others in her house, family, friends, and witnesses, fasted the day of the trial. At the church court, witnesses were not allowed to mention the ERA. Each had come prepared to deal with his or her own experiences in hearing Johnson speak, but from their personal experiences, they were unable to respond to the charges about her influence on members or non-members nationwide, assess her hindrance to worldwide programs, or address charges of false doctrine. One witness asked specifically what the false doctrine involved. There was no reply. One witness, Reba Keel, a BYU professor, warned the bishop's court that the court's ill-advised action had the power to start a witch hunt in the church for women who deviated in any way. She asked what she should say to the young women who came to her at BYU asking for her help in understanding this event. A large press contingent awaited in the cold outside the church building where the court was taking place, but the bishop waited 4 days to inform Sonya of her excommunication. She reported that her excommunication letter said, "You testified that you believed and taught that people should not let the missionaries into their homes. I testify no such thing. I never taught that. I tell everyone who interviews me about the politics involved here, that the church is organized to fight the ERA, but they edit all that out. All they're interested in is the personal angle, pitting me against the church." Sonya unsuccessfully appealed her excommunication to the state president in the First Presidency. A week after Sonya received her letter, Richard Johnson, her husband, sent the bishop a letter affirming his support for Sonya regarding the ERA and requested immediate excommunication for himself. In the same period, he had become involved with another woman and divorced Sonya. Sonya agreed with church leaders that she was not being persecuted because of her pro-ER beliefs, but because of her actions questioning the church. But she defended those activities. "We have simply told people what the church has been doing," she said. After hearing Sonya Johnson speak in early 1980, Laurel Thatcher Ulrich wrote in her diary, "Strangely enough, I don't think she is very political at all. She is disarmingly open, which is undoubtedly what got her in all this trouble. She is also very Mormon in her ability to act on faith. She said she arrived at this position through agonizing prayer and fasting. She simply could not separate her belief in the ERA from her belief in the church. Linda Sillitoe, who stayed with Sonia while reporting on the ERA conflict in Virginia and on the excommunication, reported in Utah Holiday magazine, Sonia Jansen did not do the things she was excommunicated for, saying the church leaders were savage misogynists, disrupting church programs, telling people not to obey the prophet. She did far worse. She and her Mormons for ERA exposed via the media the highly organized anti-ERA campaign, which the church claimed was only the independent efforts of concerned citizens who happened to be Mormon. For days, her excommunication story was reported nationally and unleashed a prolonged flood of investigative reporting on the church's politics and its treatment of women. Worse still, Sonia challenged priesthood authority. She played political hardball, not a girl's game. Immediately after the excommunication, at least one Virginia ward, the excommunication letter was read and a talk was given on apostasy. In some ward sacrament meetings, bishops urged congregations to follow church leaders. In one Salt Lake ward, a declaration by Elaine Cannon, general president of the Young Women's Organization, spoken in the 1978 All Church Women's Fireside, was quoted, "When the prophet speaks, sisters, the debate is over." Many women in the church, like a Relief Society president interviewed by Linda Sillitoe, expressed sentiments such as this: "I'm not happy about the political activities of the church, but either you believe the brethren receive inspiration or you don't. If they believe we should work against the ERA, that's their decision. I've been taught all my life to support the purposes of the church." Sonia's anger in our culture that values being nice at all costs made it difficult for many Mormons to empathize with her. And many looked at her post-excommunication experiences as proof that she was not a good role model. Linda Sillitoe said several years later, "Sonia was not a good martyr. Thus, the culture had to kill her again and again with rumors of the worst possible curse. She had gained 60 pounds. All her sons were gay. She was bitter and miserable. How is Sonia now?" people would ask me months later. "She's great," I would say, and watch their faces fall. Not only did she keep living, but she changed and kept changing, moving through causes on her own radical trajectory as we fought to maintain our status. She became more outrageous as we became more cautious. After the excommunication, she continued to work for ERA. She spoke at the 1980 Democratic Convention. She appeared on television programs such as Phil Donahue. When she did, she expressed willingness to appear alongside a church leader, but she refused to appear alongside Beverly Campbell, the appointed ERA chairman in Virginia. I concluded that I must make it policy never to appear with Mormon women on such programs as the men in Salt Lake so obviously wished me to do. I recognized the syndrome I had watched in Virginia. The men behind the women fronting for them, the men never having to be accountable, never having to take responsibility, the women serving as unwitting tools of their own oppression. For the same reason, she didn't even name Campbell in her autobiography, always referring to her as the Virginia chairman. Sonia despaired of the fragmenting among women while men were trained in teamwork for childhood and automatically support one another. She protested at various venues like the Republican Party headquarters in Washington. She was one of 20 ERA supporters who were arrested, briefly jailed, for chaining themselves to the gates of the Bellevue Washington Temple during open houses there. She stated, "That was a grand day in my life. Women have to risk civil obedience for their rights." In 1982, she and others staged a 37-day hunger strike in an unsuccessful effort to pressure the Illinois legislature to ratify the ERA. In 1982, after the failure of the ERA, she made an unsuccessful bid for presidency of NOW, the National Organization of Women. In 1984, she was the presidential candidate for the Citizens Party. She became increasingly radicalized, as reflected in the book she wrote, Going Out of Our Minds, The Metaphysics of Liberation. In 1987, she details the personal and political experiences that turned her against the state. By then, she was rejecting the Equal Rights Amendment, the Supreme Court's Roe versus Wade, equal opportunity laws, and other government benefits because she considered them all co-optation by patriarchy. In Wildfire, 1990, her argument is that state violence is male violence, and women relate to male-dominated state much as women relate to battering husbands. After ending her first lesbian relationship, she wrote in The Ship That Sailed Into the Living Room, Even relationships between female couples are a dangerous patriarchal trap, synonymous with hierarchy and control. Sex is engineered as part of the siege against our wholeness and power. She founded Wildfire, a short-lived separatist commune for women that disbanded in 1993. With her partner Jade DeForest, for several years she ran Casa Feminista, a New Mexico hotel catering to feminist women. It was very successful, according to Sonia's longtime friend, Utah feminist Jan Taylor. But a few years ago, they retired from running that business and sold the property. And since then, Jan and Linda and others who had kept maintained contact with her have lost contact, so I was not even able to get in contact with Sonia. Sonia no longer has any contact with her children or birth family. The three friends who confirmed this to me offered no opinion as to her reasons. She continues to speak at feminist events, including the 2007 Feminist Hullabaloo. So this is the most recent reference I was able to find to her. Jan Taylor, her friend in Utah, heard from several people that it was a very successful event. One participant reported online, Sonia Johnson was visibly moved throughout the weekend, tearing up over and over, and especially at the Grand Cauldron at the end of the gathering, when all of the Wild sisters were drumming, dancing, hollering, singing, whooping it up like we had good sense. One afternoon we talked a little and she was kind, soft-spoken, completely unpretentious, gracious. Sonia's transformation alarmed yet satisfied Orthodox Mormons, confirming their opinions of her wrongness. In the aftermath of the excommunication, Mormon women who had agreed with Sonia in ERA felt hurt and fear. Many asked themselves, if there's no room in the church for Sonia, is there room for me? Kathleen Flake wrote 10 years later, I, like so many of my sisters, hit the deck. I just faded away into law school and benign inactivity. The staff of Exponent 2, a very moderate voice discussing feminist issues in the church, expressed uncertainty about how to discuss ERA and Sonia Johnson in their winter 1980 edition. We didn't want to contribute to possible polarization, they said, but they went ahead and published fairly objective, benign articles. Sunstone Magazine asked Linda Sillitoe to write an article about the church's anti-ERA politics, and later its editors swore they would never again publish on such a controversial topic, Linda wrote. What happened to Sonia Johnson echoed in individual excommunications, disfellowshipments, releases from church dogs, revoked temple recommends, voiced fear, hurt, and despair of scores of Mormon women, according to Linda Sillitoe. Martha Bradley, in her marvelous book that is really the best thing to read if you want a comprehensive view of all of this period, Pedestals and Podiums, she concluded something that resonates with me. And I seem to fall into the category she describes. A significant fraction of Mormon women felt the chill of social ostracism. Even if they kept their opinions to themselves and apparently continued to fit in, they no longer defined themselves as fully belonging. Did the church play a significant role in stopping ERA? Linda Sillitoe in 1980, while she was doing this reporting, expressed the hope that actually all this would help the ERA. The ultimate irony is that the bishop's court, in publicizing this, some ERA advocates claim may have turned the tide in favor of the amendment. Well, we know that wasn't to happen. And Beda told me that she really felt like the church's role was not that significant, that after the first rush of, after the first rush of legislatures ratifying ERA, the issue achieved publicity and discussion. And once it became really divisible and debated in the press, there was insufficient support for passage. But admittedly, the Mormons' efforts certainly added to the visibility that brought it to that point. I'm finished with my official remarks, but I did want to mention that Linda Sillitoe was very helpful in preparing this, and unfortunately she's in very poor health and not able to be here, not able really to see people, but she is using all her resources to continue writing, and she has a book of poetry coming out very shortly, published by Signature, so look for that. It's going to be called Owning the Moon by Signature. So I'm looking forward to hearing what Nadine has to say from a personal perspective.
Before I start my remarks that I wrote out, I wanted to comment a little bit on a few things that Kay said. On the topic of whether the church made a difference in the ERA, it's hard to say, but one thing that I learned from that whole experience was that the church is very effective in mobilizing a lot of people quickly, and therefore making it look like there's a big groundswell for whatever their position is, which we also learned in Prop 8. I'll talk about that just a little bit. On where Sonia ended up, Kay talked about her. Did you say that she had renounced lesbianism in your?
No, I didn't.
Okay, well, she kind of did, but this was interesting. The last time I saw Sonia was in the early 1990s, maybe 92, 93, and she spoke at Stanford University. And when I found out she was going to be there, I was able to make contact with her, and we went out to lunch, and then I went over and heard her speech, which was it was to a small group of feminist women studying gender issues, and a few men who were there, young men. And at that presentation, she talked about her new way of looking at life. You did say something about when she kind of renounced sex.
Yeah, and
during that talk, she talked about how she said she was not a lesbian anymore because lesbians have sex, and that she described sex as being kind of the a form of oppression, in that you have an your partner kind of starts, you know, rubbing your arm or something, and you realize you have to wake up and get into this, and so she said that after she was married to Rick for all those years, she then was married to Susan, who was her lesbian partner for a while, but she began to see the same kinds of power relationships in that marriage that relationship that she had in her marriage. And then she had another partner named Jean, and it was during this relationship with Jean where she developed this idea that lesbian relationships were following the same kind of power model that heterosexual relationships follow. What she and Jean did was unconditional touching, so they could touch each other, and it sort of progressed so that they could touch each other in sexual places, and in the end, unconditional touching began to sound a lot like sex to me. But I will say that at that time, Sonia had pretty much cut off contact with her children, and she talked about that in the presentation that she did. She had contact with her part of her birth family, is in that her mother at that time was living with them, with her and Jean, and kind of her mother had moved away from the church by this time too. And when we went to lunch, we talked about this, and I said, you know, at her age, she really shouldn't have to do this. And she said, "Yeah, I know." And I've told her that you know, if she wants to be in the church, we'll help her with that. But she really doesn't want to. And so I assume that her mother has probably passed away by now. She was getting pretty elderly at the time, but she did maintain that relationship with her mother. What she said about her children was that she was kind of opposed to motherhood by this time, and to the expectations that society puts on mothers. And she said that even though her children were grown, they kept coming back to her with their problems. And as I'm sure all of us who have grown children know, but she told them that she was not going to deal with their problems anymore, and if they have had problems, they were not to bring them to her. Now, I don't know whether her children had more problems than some of our children have, and maybe she just couldn't deal with them anymore. I always thought it was unfortunate that in her journey she had to move away from any relationship with her children. But I will say that I think she was happy. So, you know, who am I to say that she did the wrong thing? I'm sure it was hurtful to her children, however. Now, on August 5th, 1978, I was scanning through a newspaper, and a headline caught my eye. And the headline said something about Orrin Hatch and the ERA and a Mormon woman. And I read through this article, and it was about this incident where she testified before the Senate Judiciary or the Senate Subcommittee on Constitutional Rights and got into this altercation with Orrin Hatch. And I my heart literally pounded as I read this article, and I read it and reread it and reread it, because up to that time I thought I was the only woman in the church who supported the ERA, and certainly the only feminist. I think maybe young women, there aren't many here, but young women today probably cannot appreciate the isolation of feminist women in the church back in the days before they could reach each other by blogging. In the following days, my head kind of swirled with an obsession to get in touch with this woman. I didn't know how to do it. We didn't have the internet. I couldn't look her up that way. But I found an address for a group in Utah that supported the ERA, and I wrote to them and asked if they knew how to get in touch with Sonia Johnson. They sent me back a little pamphlet that was called Another Mormon View of the ERA, and they gave me her contact information. So I wrote her a letter, and pretty soon we were in phone contact. And I spent a lot of time on the telephone talking to her. And I thought I would maybe read to you just a little bit of her testimony before Congress and what I think upset Orrin Hatch so much. In her testimony, she talked about the early feminist movement in the LDS Church, and and she said that she quoted from Exponent and about you know, there are a lot of quotes, I'm sure many of you read them, about how the in the Exponent women were fighting for the vote and for equal rights. And so she had a lot of good feminist rhetoric right from the history of the Mormon Church that she quoted. And then she said that in the church's statement against the ERA, it referred to women's exalted role in society and how the ERA would harm women's exalted role. She said, we can express our dismay at, well, okay, let me go back a little. In the official statement opposing the ERA, the leaders of the church affirm the exalted role of women in society and then proceed to withdraw support for an amendment which would give her equal protection under the law. We can express our dismay at this equivocation no better than one Mormon sister did in 1880. Is this all, this shadow without substance, that our brethren can afford to give us? And then she said, she talks about this woman, and she said, she would have been angered to learn that less than 100 years hence, in the late 1960s, our brethren would suddenly consider us too exalted to continue to offer prayers in our sacrament meetings, a right inherent in church membership from the very beginning, so exalted that they abolished the magazine which had been published in some form since 1872 by and for women of the church. We are so exalted that young women must be several years older than their male peers in order to serve a mission for the church, and are not encouraged to do so at any age. So exalted that we are not allowed to manage the budget for our own women's auxiliary, to organize, plan, or conduct major church services that are not primarily for females or children. So exalted that we cannot stand in the circle where our own babies are being christened by our husbands and male friends. So exalted that we are encouraged to sacrifice our educations to support our husbands in obtaining theirs. So exalted that we should do that by far the greater share of the difficult task of parenting, because our husbands are too busy with the important matters of church and business. Where equality does not pertain, the word exalted is a mockery. And I understand that during the testimony in part of this exchange, Hatch got very upset and he pounded on the table and said, "Now that's an insult to my wife." I have a couple little stories too about some fallout from this speech, and also something else that the women back in Virginia did. I don't really remember the letter that precluded women from praying in church. I just kind of always in the wards that I was in, women never prayed, and I didn't hear the letter, and so I just kind of always thought of it as a custom, and I didn't know there was a rule against it. Apparently, I was not the only woman. Sonia told me that there was a woman whose husband was a BYU professor. She never told me the name of the person, but this woman had a beautiful singing voice and used to sing in sacrament meeting. And she read Sonia's remarks, and that was the first that she knew of the rule. And she, I guess, had connections and said, "I will not sing in sacrament meeting again until this rule is rescinded, because my song is a prayer unto the Lord." And it was after that that they did rescind the rule. Another incident that Sonia told me about was that when they were the Congress was debating whether to extend the ratification period for 3 more years. And Jake Garn and some other conservative senators were doing a filibuster. And so Sonia and the other founding mothers of Mormons for ERA went and visited him. And Teddy, who's Teddy? Hi, Teddy. Maybe you can talk about this. Okay, I think I won't tell that story because I'd rather hear it from you. I'll save time for you. Huh? Yeah, I'd really like to hear you tell a story about going to visit Jake Garn and what happened with the filibuster. So in early May of 1979, I moved to the home that would be my home and my ward for the next 19 years. And I simultaneously embarked on my new career as a Mormon feminist activist, an unusual way to make an entrance into a new ward. I soon made my way into the public forum by writing a letter to the editor talking about Mormon involvement in opposing ratification of the ERA. And that had the effect of allowing me to very quickly separate the Iron Rod Saints in my ward from the Liahonas. Soon after that, Sonia Johnson visited the Bay Area, and we arranged to have lunch with an old friend of hers. She actually had lived in the Bay Area and had friends there. And so we went to lunch, and we really became good friends, at least from my perspective, and I think from Sonia's too. And before I had even heard of Sonia, I had actually read 3 books about the Equal Rights Amendment. And I knew all these terms about suspect classification and legislative intent and strict scrutiny, and learned a lot about how the courts look at the law. And so I'd gotten quite adept at talking about it. And as I became more public about it, I gave some talks and talked to a few reporters, and people started asking me if I was a lawyer or if I had legal training. I was at this point a college dropout with 4 kids, but I was going to school, and I was talking to Sonia one day, and I said to her, you know, people keep asking me if a lawyer, and I'm sort of wondering if maybe I'm missing my calling, and I don't know what I'm going to do after I get out of school, but I've been thinking about maybe going to law school. The only thing is, it'd probably take me 6 years because I don't even have an undergrad degree yet. And she said, "Well, Nadine, the 6 years are going to go by anyway. You might as well do what you want." And something sort of clicked in my head, and I set my sights on going to law school, and the rest is history. It in some way changed the whole course of my life. I did a few activist activities worth repeating, the most amusing of which involved baking apple pies and presenting them to some visiting church people. I did one to the LDS Relief Society president, Barbara Smith, and another for G. Homer Durham. And I baked the apple pie, and then I put in 3 little paper flags that were on toothpicks. And I gave this, and then I put on it with icing, "Equality is as American as apple pie." And I gave one to Barbara Smith, and then another one to G. Homer Durham. when I gave G. Homer Durham his, he started to tell me the reasons why I shouldn't support the Equal Rights Amendment. And when I wasn't quickly dissuaded, he said, "Oh, you're just like my daughter-in-law. She's a federal judge in Utah, and I can't change her mind either." That daughter-in-law, Christine Durham, is now the Chief Justice of the Utah State Supreme Court. I printed out her APA speech that I think sort of sealed her doom, the speech to the American Psychological Association. I don't have time to read parts of it here today, but if you're interested, Google Patriarchal Panic. That was the name of the speech, along with Johnson or something, and it will pop up. Steve Benson posted the entire text on the internet a while back. And I think that after that speech, her excommunication was a pretty foregone conclusion. I really had a lot of fun preparing this talk and going back and looking through my papers. I'm a pack rat. I keep things. And one of the things that I found was Sonia Johnson's papers surrounding her excommunication. The letter exchange between her and her bishop, her appeal first to the High Council and then to the First Presidency, and there's a lot of information there, but I am going to vow right now to come back next year and do a paper on the excommunication of Sonia Johnson, a case study in church discipline, because I think it would be a fascinating topic that really discloses the disadvantage that church members have in any kind of a church disciplinary setting. Now, in my ward, there was a woman who was, she was younger than me, and she had at one point been married briefly, and then the marriage didn't work out, and so she went on a mission, and she came back, and she was really trying to find her place in the church. And when she became aware of what I was doing, she sought me out for friendship, and we talked about the ERA, and she became a born-again convert to the ERA. And her name was Cheryl Dalton. And I was always pretty circumspect about not making the church, per se, a forum for my political views. I wanted to make it clear that my political views were not... The church was not my political views, and I didn't want to bring my political views into the church. Cheryl had no such compunctions, and she was very, very open. I'm going to read just a little bit about some of the things she did so that I won't forget anything. The church sent out this pamphlet with the ensign, The Church and the Proposed Equal Rights Amendment, a Moral Issue. And one of my friends in my ward said, "I read it and I threw it across the room." But Cheryl took a different tack, and she wrote a point-by-point rebuttal, very thoroughly annotated, and handed them out to anybody who she could get to take one. She insisted on getting up each month in testimony meeting and bearing her testimony about things like equality in general and the ERA in particular and Mother in Heaven. The bishop made a rule, which he announced, that people should only bear their testimony once every 3 or 4 months. She ignored the rule. She went to General Conference along with the other women, and when the authorities of the church were sustained, the women shouted out, "No, ERA policy, no." As a result, the three women got an audience with Gordon Hinckley, who at that time was the head of the Special Affairs Committee, which was orchestrating the church's anti-ERA campaign. And so they met with him, and Cheryl told me, "We called him Gordon." Cheryl and other women then went to Seattle, and they were chained themselves to the gates of the temple. The bishop demanded surrender of her temple recommend. She refused. He notified the temple president not to allow her into the temple. She went anyway and convinced the people at the desk that she was a different Cheryl Dalton than the one they had been warned against. For a award talent show, she wrote and performed songs promoting women's equality. She made a tape of the songs she wrote, including one about Phyllis Schlafly that said, "I had a reach you later, but I couldn't spell." And that's all I want to say. And finally, she took a sabbatical leave from her teaching position to go on an ERA mission across the country. On the mission, she performed her songs, sold her tapes. Teddy might. Did you meet her?
Do you remember? I know her.
Oh, okay.
Someone, yes, I knew her.
Okay. Yeah, and she sold her tapes and gave speeches, I think. And the other thing she did is she found out where they were having state conferences, and she went around and took apple pies to the visiting general authorities. And I guess that once they got on to her, they started obstructing her access. And so she adopted disguises to get in so that she could present her pies. Although I never really condoned her actions with regard to being so in your face at church, I couldn't help fantasizing that one day when her mission was over, she would return to our ward and show up in testimony meeting and deliver a mission report. She never indulged my fantasy. In the end, she went to law school at night and became a practicing attorney, fell in love with a lesbian partner, and adopted a little girl who she told me was the light of her life. What I learned from my experience with the church's involvement of the ERA was about how much influence the church could have and do it quietly. And as many of you know, last year, I set up a website called Mormons for Eight, which was a website in which we listed the names of all of the donors to Prop 8 in California, and we invited everyone to send us emails identifying the Mormon donors. And so all of the publicity that you saw about how much money Mormons contributed to the Prop 8 fight in California was largely my responsibility because we made this public. We identified that of the large donors, 50% of the donors were Mormon, and we know that there were many, many more donors who we were not able to identify. And the story went on and on. It appeared in print in England and like Indonesia, and I did an interview with a Spanish reporter from what he told me was the leading newspaper in Spain. So the story went far and wide. When I talked with him, I asked him what had happened in Spain with where they had legalized gay marriage. I said, did the world come to an end? And he said, not only did the world not come to an end, nobody can even remember what all the fuss was about. And that was one of the things that I the gift that keeps on giving, I guess. One day, after I'd known Sonia for some time, I told her about a fantasy I had sometimes entertained. I told her about a made-for-TV movie starring Michael Lannon, in which as a teenager he was a bedwetter. To try to shame him out of wetting his bed, his mother would hang a sheet out the window for his friends to see. To avoid having it seen, he would run home from school every day and take it down before his friends could see it. As a result, he became a track star. At the end of the movie, he did a media interview in which someone asked him what had contributed to excess. He paused and then said, "I guess you could say I owe it all to my parents." I told Sonia, "Someday, if I ever amount to anything, and someone asks me how I became a success, I think I will reply, I guess you could say I owe it all to the church." On June 30th, the Equal Rights Amendment went down to defeat when it failed to be ratified by the three additional states needed to place it in the Constitution. I joined other feminists at a rally in San Francisco's Golden Gate Park. Before I left to go to the rally, I placed a letter in the mail to my bishop, dated the next day, July 1st, and I resigned from all of my church's positions. I copied Spencer Kimball, Gordon Hinckley, and my stake president. In August, I started my last year of undergraduate school, and the next year went to law school. And I owe it all to the church.
Teddy tell her story about visiting the Congress.
Yeah, Jake Garn, yeah.
Okay.
Hello. Excommunication is a unoriginal idea. It's intimidation at best. And so I'm not here to celebrate. Sure, I mark it, absolutely. The day we went, that three of us went, Sonia didn't make it to that session on we took a very shriveled old basketball, you know, and because the churches said, don't change the rules in the middle of the game. Well, about the extension of 70 more years to discuss the Equal Rights Amendment. And one of my colleagues, Hazel, said, I want to go up and... They never listen to us. And so, now that was one thing we always said. They never listen to our side. And that's why my children thought up banner toes. And our first banner toe, which flew over Salt Lake, said, patriarchy is malarkey. And it was kind of a stunner. And I noticed that that's not shown up anywhere too much. You know, we don't get too much of that banner toe. But it was... we had to persuade somebody quite hard. The first businessman in Salt Lake to have a banner toe agreed after several hours on the phone over the week that we weren't totally, totally crazed. And he flew that banner toe. We had to get permission from the city council, etc. But anyway, back to the basketball. Hazel said, oh, we've got to go. And I said, okay, I'll sign out of work. I was working for Anderson Missile Defense at the time. I have a master's in public administration and a long history of different work as a public servant and as a researcher, and especially in management, large organization theory, and strategy and politics have always been really of interest to me. I grew up in Rexburg, Idaho, which hung Ernest Wilkinson in effigy once because he tried to steal our college. Of course, there was a real estate deal down 28 miles away in Idaho Falls. Somebody related to him, allegedly, was where the new spot was to be. Our town formed a committee of 1,000. My father-in-law and my grandmother were part of that, and they made monthly or bi-weekly trips to visit with President McKay. And finally, that was changed because they had found in the prayer dedicating the college that college would never be moved in the dedicatory prayer. And so finally President McKay, not only kept it there, but it's flourishing and it's now Brigham Young, Idaho. So I come from and they did hang Wilkinson in effigy to show his disdain, their disdain for him. So I come from a town of fighters and we got into Jake Garn's office with our shriveled basketball and on it it said, changing the rules of the game is no big new deal, on amendments. It's also the only amendment, I'm told, that had a deadline put on it. So feel unique, ladies and gentlemen, on that one. That's feminist, if you are a feminist. I always say I'm a Mormon feminist, and I like that that approach. I'm also an American and a Mormon. And that gives you a lot of experience in world history, the very traditional and the very more experimental of our American democracy. So we got Jake Garn, and he was waxing strong about what a good guy he was and how fond of women and, how he was respected women and so forth. But he went on too long, and we just let him. It was about 5 o'clock on a Wednesday, I believe. And... he went on and on, just mostly talking about himself, and we were just kind of, going and asking him what he was going to do to show his words had some meaning to women. And his staff person started calling, knocking on the door and opening the door, you've got to get back to the Senate. He said, in a minute. Well, he went on and on, and then she'd come again, you've got to get to the Senate, they need you. And he'd come off the floor from this filibuster, and Senator Byrd from West Virginia saw him gone, and he said, we're going to call us to a vote, and we got 7 more years. because
three,
he wasn't
three
there.
Years. 3 more years.
Okay, three more years. Yeah, they had hoped for what, seven?
I guess.
They got 3 more years. Thank you. And he was awful. And if you look at the Senate record, we had a dinner party and took the parts and read them of when he went begging over there and hysterical to get him to change because it was over and done. The next day, I called now and said, "What time did that happen?" Because it was a big headline. They said, "Oh, about 5 o'clock." So Hazel did well to get me to go. You know, I always said, well, I don't know that women have ever been really full members of the church, so I don't know that an excommunication would, you know, maybe really sort of work. I mean, I'm not sure. But anyway, I'm here to say it was sad. But that's not the first sad thing that's happened to us as women. I mean, I've got a lot of stories, I'll tell you. But I grew up as a really good person wanting to be a good Mormon. And I've written letters to the church about blacks as a kid, about Eve as a child, just starting in the scriptures. And finally, to President Joseph Smalley Smith, after I'd been through the temple and seen the very horrid treatment of Eve in that older script. That would have been about the early 60s. And so I wrote and said, "What is in this church for women?" Well, I didn't get an answer, so I thought that's the answer. I mean, in a way. And anyway, so Jake Garn, we read the... You've got to get that sometime. Look up the record. That's fun, too. We read those parts because he was really upset. And I'm sure he took some guff from his male friends. Anyway, I'm not gonna. To me, Sonia was a terrific colleague. I moved from Germany a little early from a job I had there on management research for the West German government and Management Institute in West Berlin. And I came back and was going to try to see what we could do, you know, in Washington. I knew it was a good place for a family fight because there's good press. And sure, you can live by the sword and die by the sword, but what the heck, if you're an open person, you can handle the heat. And women are good at that. They're sturdy. They're incredible. And those of you who feel you need to be more cautious, that's your call. That's your sacred call. And I think, Sonia, if you don't think she's been having a good time, you're wrong. And she has, sure, it's been difficult. It's been amazing for us to get to watch this woman move from no Levi's and to catch on fire. And she and I had runners that I worked in the federal government about 4 or 5 different agencies on projects I really liked. I could pick my boss if I took a little time, you know. And so we had things, paperwork running back and forth between us. It was great to see her get launched. And then she really wanted her independence in a way, and from that group. And I said, hey, that's cool, you know, great, go for it. And she was fabulous as a consciousness. She is fabulous as a consciousness raiser. I tried to get now to hire her or to at least fund her to go around the country, unleashed and speaking on a speaking tours instead of try to get in a fight on, you know, who wanted to be president of now. Her strength did never seem to me to be organizing. But that's so what? I mean, a consciousness raiser, sure. I said, now would be fabulous if they just, even without getting a lot of PR for that for now, just give her some money, send her out, and that's really a service to the country. So I wish she were here today. I'm troubled that she isn't here today. And it's a little hard to imagine because she loves the limelight. There is no, and she will say that she had told me that at one point. So I was kind of the press person to get her launched. And my kids and our kids were with us. It was a profound experience. I won't say that it was easy all the time, but it was great fun, and I owe a great deal to feminists in Utah who were hospitable and worked with us. A whole lot of folks, Linda Sillito, Marilyn Waransky, do any of you know her book? Fabulous person. And Linda Cilito, of course, Swenson lined her up to do a paragraph or something on Virginia. Well, it ended up in being at least two full issues with pictures that I'd gotten on the, you know, for the one cover. So the history isn't all written yet, but I have something for you if you're interested. My phone number, if you want to talk. I'm out of here because you probably want to go somewhere else. But I also put my doodles. I've been in Alaska with my grandkids, and we've got these. This is my doodling thinking about this. It's painful and hard because I never wanted to write a book. I was busy living it. And so we made sure the reporting was pretty darn good. And Cilito was a fabulous find. Esther Landa was a wonderful supporter of me personally. And, well, the list is very long.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, very good. Appreciate it.